tended to be very interested in the progressive development of these great powers down through history, which is quite important to be sure. But more and more I'm coming to realize that the two important periods are, first of all, the mighty experience of Daniel himself, which is conveyed in the history part of the book of Daniel, what might have been during the 490 years, and again during the apostolic period after the 490 years, and then to recognize that the period of papal supremacy was a period of delay, which should never have been, and only down here at the very end of time will we finally find the work of God doing what it might have done centuries before. Later, when we come to the last chapter of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, and in fact Daniel chapter 11 too, we'll find this thought brought out with great strength and power in that part of the book of Daniel. Let's move on now to the 8th chapter, which is the second and final vision that the prophet had. And what follows in the rest of the book of Daniel is an explanation of Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8. Right, let's follow this through now. We have different symbolism, and it's important to recognize that the vision came in the third or final year of the reign of King Belshazzar, as verse 1 tells us. Only a few days, weeks, or months at best now remain before the attacking armies of the Medo-Persians would bring down the proud Babylonian Empire and forever reduce it to ruins. So chapter 8, verse 1, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw, that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I was in the vision, and I was by the river of Uli. Then I lifted up mine eyes, and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were higher, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. Now I'd like you to make a special note of those last three words, he became great. Because very soon as we move on, we'll find the next power is referred to in comparably greater terms, and the last power in even greater terms still. And that important comparison helps us very much in the positive identification of the little horn power of Daniel chapter 8, which is the same little horn power of Daniel chapter 7. So make a special note of those words, the ram became great. Now verse 5, and as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came up, came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great. So which of those two is the greater power, the great power or the very great power? Right, the very great power. Make a note of that statement too. Verse 8 continues with these words, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now verse 9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And how did this horn wax or grow? Great, very great or? Exceeding great. So we have three successive powers. The first one was great, the second one very great, and the third one exceeding great. So of the three, which was the greatest power? The last. The first one was a world empire. What therefore did the very great one have to be? Nothing less than a world empire. And the exceeding great had to be also what? A world empire, as it proved to be. Let's be on now through further specifications in regard to this little horn power. Verse 10, you find, of course, there's more details given about the little horn power than is given about the other two before it. Verse 10, and it waxed great. even to the host of heaven, and cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground, stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily was taken away. The word sacrifice there is very definitely supplied, so we don't read it. It's italicized, you find in most Bibles, all those Bibles which do italicize additional words, italicize that word sacrifice. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host trodden under foot? That's a question, isn't it? That's a question. And here is the answer, verse 14, and he served to me unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. That answer, the 2,300 days, must always be studied in relation to that question, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to trod on the foot? And the answer, 2,300 days, or in other words, 2,300 years. We're now placed on the board before our eyes an outline of what we've read so far in the prophecy of Daniel chapter 8, in which first of all we find that there was a ram. And the ram was followed by an he-goat, which had one notable horn, one great horn between his eyes. Now that horn became broken, snapped off, and out of it there grew four horns, and then came a little horn. This is a real chapter of horns, isn't it? A little horn, and note very carefully that this little horn waxed exceeding great in three directions. And what were those three directions? Thank you. Toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. So we'll put those three words here. First of all, toward the south, then the east, and then last of all, the pleasant land, which we know to be, of course, the land of Palestine. And then comes the question, of course, other things too, that he would take away the daily, cast down the sanctuary, and trample upon the people of God. Then comes the question, the answer was for 2,300 days. We'll now move on to the next part of this prophecy, where the explanation begins to be given to these various details as revealed in the dream. We now turn to verse 15. And it came to pass, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Uli, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. Who is Gabriel? Well, first of all, he's an angel, isn't he? First of all, he's an angel. Now, what position does Gabriel occupy today? Up in heaven, right, the position that was once occupied by Lucifer. Isn't that so? He is Lucifer's direct replacement, at least until the saints find their place in the kingdom. Now, when the voice of this one who spoke, whom we assume to be Jesus Christ, commanded Gabriel, and it could be none other than Christ, because he was the only one who's above Gabriel, to make Daniel understand the vision, then how much of that vision was he directed to explain to Daniel? Part of it? Most of it? No, all of it. Right. That's worth keeping in mind because of what follows. Verse 17, so, in other words, being a very obedient angel, he obeyed the command of God. So he came near where I stood, and when he came I was afraid and fell upon my face, but he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. He said, behold, I'll make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for the time appointed the end shall be. Now, this angel Gabriel is emphasizing a very important point here, and what is that point? Right, he would make Daniel understand what would be in the last end of the indignation. In other words, the whole focus of attention is not on the intervening history, not upon the long delays, even though they're outlined, but rather the focus of attention is upon the ultimate victory, that which might have been long, long before. That's where the attention of Daniel is directed. So where shall our attention likewise be directed? The same place. Verse 20, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. That, of course, leaves absolutely no question as to what the ram symbolizes, namely the kings of Media and Persia. One horn, of course, symbolizing each of those powers. And as you know, the higher one came up last, and you find that the greater of those two kingdoms was the second one to rise to power, which I think was the Persian, yes. Now in verse 21, and the rough goat is the king of Grisha, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. So in plain terms, we're told that the goat then was Grisha, and without question it was a greater power than was the Medo-Persian power. And this one great horn was the first king, whose name was Alexander the Great, the first great monarch to rule over the rising power of the Medo-Persians. Now verse 22 says, now that being broken, now that of course speaks in terms of the breaking of Alexander, which infers of course his death, as it turned out to be. Now that being broken, verse 22, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. Right. So as we mentioned in our last study from Daniel 7, there was a division of the Alexandrian Empire into four partitions, and the four kings who led out in this were Seleucus, Lysimachus, Cassander, and Ptolemy. Seleucus, of course, was the king of the north. Lysimachus, I think he was out in the east. Cassander was in what we now know as being Greece itself, and we know, of course, that Ptolemy very definitely was the ruler down there in Egypt. Lysimachus, Cassander, and Ptolemy were those four divisions, or the four men, I should say, who led out into divisions of the Grecian Empire. They were not the sons of Alexander, but they were four of his generals or leaders, who took their particular army strength and occupied those four different territories. The next verse goes on to say, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Now then, we'll now reiterate a very, very important point made in part earlier in the series. And the important point is this, that these chapters in Daniel have two parts. The first part is the prophetic part, and the second part is the interpretation. And we will never find a symbol in the vision, excepting that symbol has an interpretation in the other part of the chapter. Now so far we have been able to match very, very clearly Medo-Persia with the ram, Grecia with the he-goat, the first king with the one horn, and the four divisions with his other two horns. Now we have to match the symbol of the little horn with its explanation. Now, can you, or have we so far read, can you see in what we've read so far, an explanation of the little horn so far? Well, when it says in verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom, now whose kingdom? Whose kingdom? Right, the four. In the latter time of their kingdom, what was the next event in the actual prophecy? The rise of the little horn. What is the next event in the explanation? A king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. So who must this king be? Right, very good. It must be the little horn power. It's worth noticing, of course, you arise when two things have taken place. The latter time of the kingdom of the four horns, so right down toward the end of their period of power, and at the same time when the transgressors are come to the full. That is to full iniquity and full rebellion against the cause and the truth of God. Now this, of course, was about the time that Jesus Christ appeared upon this earth. And it's interesting to notice in Desire of Ages, page 36, that when Christ came to this world, sin had come to its absolute maturity. Let me read you those words on page 36 of the book Desire of Ages. It says here, and this chapter, by the way, is called The Fullness of Time, which refers to the time when Jesus Christ was sent into the world from Galatians, the fourth chapter, I think verse 4. In describing that era of unrestrained wickedness, the Word of God says that the deception of sin had reached its height. All the agencies for depraving the souls of men had been put in operation. The Son of God, looking upon the world, beheld suffering and misery. With pity he saw how men had become victims of satanic cruelty. And so we're plainly told that wickedness had come to its full and final maturity. A little further down, it's the satanic agencies were incorporated with men. The bodies of human beings made for the dwelling place of God had become the habitation of demons. The senses, the nerves, the passions, the organs of men were worked by supernatural agencies in the indulgence of the vilest lust. The very stamp of demons was impressed upon the countenances of men. Human faces reflected the expression of the legions of evil with which they were possessed. Such was the prospect upon which the world's Redeemer looked. What a spectacle for infinite purity to behold. Now, we need to identify this power beyond any possible shadow or doubt, because in the last days, the enemy is bent upon attacking the sanctuary truth. And the sanctuary truth, of course, depends upon the correct application of 2,300-day prophecy, which in turn depends upon the correct identification of the little horn power. Now, what power alone could qualify to meet the definition as being exceeding great in comparison to a very great Grisha and a great Medo-Persia? What power alone can measure up to that kind of description? Rome. Only Rome could. That little horn power could be only, first of all, papal Rome, and then later, of course, the papacy, because these words cover Rome in both her pagan and papal form, just as the two legs of the image of Daniel 2 cover the pagan and the papal era of the Babylonian or Roman Empire. Now the question arises, did Rome wax exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land in that order? Now, if you think about it, that's an unnatural order. Let's draw a little map again here of the Mediterranean Basin. I should have one here on the board permanently, shouldn't I, for these particular studies. Here's Asia Minor and Palestine and Egypt and so forth. Now, any conquering army which went first of all to the south would naturally go where next? The pleasant land. Wouldn't you think that would be kind of a good strategy or way to go? And last of all, take the conquest out to the east. That's the natural progression one would expect. And if a person was a human prophet, that's what he'd say. Okay, we go first. But instead it says he went to the south, then he went to the east, and then he came back again, last of all, to the pleasant land, which was an unnatural and rather impractical progression of invasion. We'll now look again at Antiochus Epiphanes, because he is the power. As I said in our last study period, I was absolutely amazed when I was Australia just a few months ago to hear a Seventh Adventist minister say to me, "A time has come when I don't believe I can any longer prove the 2,300-day prophecy from the Bible and the Bible only. I would have to depend upon the spirit of prophecy to do that, and I don't believe that's right. If I can't prove it from the Bible and the Bible only, then I have to suspect the teachings of the spirit of prophecy in this connection." In fact, this man said, "The more I read my Bible, the more I'm convinced that Antiochus Epiphanes is the little horn power of Daniel chapter 8. Now, I want to demonstrate today to your complete satisfaction that Antiochus Epiphanes cannot in any sense of the word be the little horn power of Daniel chapter 8. And I do this to fortify your minds against the deceptions of these last days, because you can be absolutely certain that our enemies during the loud quiet period are going to press upon us the arguments that support the idea that Antiochus Epiphanes was indeed that little horn power. Now it's true that he did do things which appear to have fulfilled certain specifications of the prophecy. He did take away the daily sacrifice from the Old Testament sanctuary during the 3 years and a half, roughly, that he was there in Jerusalem. He did place upon the sacred altars an abomination in the form of swine's flesh. That's about where his similarity to the prophecy begins and ends. Now, first of all, let's examine the specification. It would wax exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land.
I'll just take off the board here now, all these red lines, so we can draw a new picture in this respect, to show us just the way in which Antiochus Epiphanes went out in his warfare and his intention of rebuilding the glorious might of the Alexandrian Empire. Now, he was a Seleucid, so therefore he was located, his kingdom was located up here in Asia Minor. And well down toward the end of the Seleucid Empire, around about 200 or 300 BC, he made up his mind that he was going to be a very, very great fellow. So he gathered an army, trained the army, and he set out on his conquest. And his first conquest was to the south. He went down to invade the land of Egypt. So far, so good. He went toward the south. Let's see if he waxed exceeding great there, though. At that time, the Egyptians were were tributary to the Romans. They were not able to defend themselves against Antiochus Epiphanes. So they sent a message by a fast ship to the Romans and told them their predicament, that they were being invaded by this man Antiochus. Would they please send help? Well, the Romans said, well, we know this Antiochus. He doesn't amount to anything very much. And so the Romans did not send an army nor a navy. All they sent was a messenger from the Roman Senate. And I think he was one of the senators. I believe his name was Lepidus, L-E-P-I-D-U-S, if I'm not mistaken. Well, this man sent by the Romans, without an army, just a servant, that's all he took with him, he was dressed not in armor, but in a simple white linen dress, which was the insignia of a senator of the Roman Forum. And he arrived at Alexandria and simply said, well, where is this Antiochus? And he was told, well, he's down in the desert and he's presently marching on the city of Alexandria. And the dismayed Egyptians said, well, where is the army? Where is the navy? Where are our deliverers and helpers? And this messenger said, don't worry, he said, I will handle Antiochus. So he goes out and he meets Antiochus, advancing at the head of his army in all their ordered ranks. And this man said to Antiochus, I am from Rome, and the emperor of Rome commands you to leave Egypt at once. Well, Antiochus wasn't about to do that. He looked at this one man there before him and said, no, I will not leave. I have come here to conquer this land, and I shall conquer it. Whereupon this Roman senator grew quite cross. He had a wand in his hand, 2 or 3 feet long, and he drew a circle in the sand around about Antiochus and said to him, now look, he said, before you stir out of that circle, I want your assurance that you'll leave Egypt at once. Antiochus looked at the circle in the sand, looked at the messenger from Rome, and behind that messenger he saw the might of the growing Roman Empire, and after only a few seconds reflection he said, okay, I'll leave. And he left. I ask you a simple question. Who was the exceeding great power in the south at that moment? The mighty Romans who could send a messenger who carried the threat of a mighty army to follow if need be, or Antiochus who, like a weak little lamb, packed his bags and left the land at the command of a single unarmed man? Who was the exceeding great power? Absolutely. Was Antiochus exceeding great in the south? Anything but. He didn't conquer it. He packed his bags and went across the land of Palestine, and he took up residence in Jerusalem for about 3.5 years. Now he's out of order, because the Bible says the south and the east. And what's he doing? The south and the pleasant land. The real order was the south, the east, then the pleasant land. He went from the south to the pleasant land, and last of all he went to the east. So he doesn't fulfill the order laid down in the prophecy. Well, of course, I suppose we could say God made rather a mistake, or God was just being very shoddy in his specifications. Can we subscribe to those ideas? When God makes a prophecy, it's accurate, isn't it? It's accurate. When God says 1260 years, he means 1260 years, not 1259 or 1261 or any other close by approximation. When God says that number, he means that number, no more and no less. And when God said to the south, the east, then the pleasant land, that's what God was talking about. And any other power which came along to the south, the pleasant land of the east, is not the power, because it does not fulfill the specification. Now, the story of Antiochus can be read in the book of Maccabees, which, as you know, of course, is the first book of the Apocrypha. What is the Apocrypha? It's a collection of supposedly canonical books. What do we mean by the word canonical? Inspired, right? The canon of Scripture is Genesis to Revelation. And we call all those books canonical because they are inspired and have a rightful place in the Scriptures. The Apocrypha is a series of books, the first two of which are historical, and they're called Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. I don't have a copy with me. Maybe someone has a copy in this place, perhaps not. You find it always included in the Roman Catholic Bible. And the Roman Catholic Church, of course, claims that these books are inspired and they do have a place in, along with the rest of the Bible books. Now, the book of Esdras, I've just forgotten the names of the other books now, but neither have bothered to read them through. I have looked at them briefly, and some of them contain the most fantastic kind of fairy tales, which are supposedly miracles of God, and it's no difficulty to understand why Protestant people have rejected these books as being, as having no part in the Scriptures. But the first book of Maccabees is worth reading, at least insofar as it tells the story of Antiochus Epiphanes in Jerusalem. Now, an attempt is made on Antiochus' supporters in modern-day history to prove that he took away exactly 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices. Not 2,300 days, but 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices, which would make a figure of something like, what's the half of 2,300 days? 1,150, isn't it? 1,150 actual days of his being there in Jerusalem, which doesn't quite make up the 1,260 days. Now, when you carefully calculate the time, which you can do from the first book of Maccabees, the number of days that Antiochus was in Jerusalem, he doesn't even hit that mark. It's only a rough, close-by figure. And right now, I've just forgotten how many days it was, but he comes short of the actual 1,150 days required to take away 2,300 evenings and mornings. But he did take away the daily sacrifice for that period of time. And he did place the abomination upon the altar for that period of time. But the abomination, of course, was a sacrifice of swine's flesh. It was not the actual abomination that makes desolate, which, of course, is man in the place of God. Mind you, of course, he put himself in the place of God. Now, after about 3 years, the Maccabees brothers revolted. They raised an army of Jews, and these two young men led a very vigorous assault upon the capital and drove Antiochus out of Jerusalem and forced him to flee into the land of Persia. Now, does that sound like being exceeding great in the pleasant land? If he was driven out by a few Jews? Anything but. And in Asia Minor, in Persia, where he finally went, he had a series of very, very sad reverses and finally died of a fever. So he was not exceeding great in the south, he was not exceeding great in the pleasant land, and he was not exceeding great in the east. None of those places. But do we find that Rome was exceeding great in the south? We've just seen that, haven't we? Was she exceeding great in the land of Persia? Very much so. And was she exceeding great in the land of Palestine? For hundreds of years, that exceeding great power literally dominated the world and continued to do so until that point of time when her debaucheries robbed her of her power and left her exposed to the invading barbarians from the north and from the northeast. Without question, then, the only exceeding great power that rose up at that point of time after Medo Persia and Greece was that it could only be pagan Rome followed in turn by papal Rome. So we come back then to Daniel the 8th chapter. I should mention, by the way, if you've never heard what I've said today and you are suddenly confronted with the arguments about Antiochus Epiphanes, you'd find them very, very hard to meet. I did when I first found myself confronted by those things, and I almost lost my faith in the Advent message because of those particular arguments. When you realise the few points I made this morning, of course, you very quickly realise that Antiochus is only a very generalised fulfilment, not a specific fulfilment of that important prophecy. We now read from verse 24, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. What does this expression mean, that Rome would be powerful, mighty, but not by her own power? Whose power does Rome use to gain the ascendancy of the entire world? Satan's power? I would say God's power. It's God's power usurped, of course, and misapplied. Just the same as Nebuchadnezzar took the powers of God and used them for a purpose that God never intended that they should be used for. And furthermore, Rome used the power of other people to achieve her supremacy. Every time she conquered a race, she took the people, the soldiers of that race, and incorporated them in her own armies, trained them in the Roman ways of warfare. So very often the Roman armies were made up of more other races than they were Romans themselves. But most importantly, of course, the principle is that it was by God's power usurped and misapplied that she was able to achieve what she did, because how much can Satan do by the power which he himself has? Of himself. Nothing, because he has no power of himself, does he? All the power that Satan has is of God and from God, which is true of our situation as well. Now, what statement, we now need to compare the explanation with the prophecy itself, and what statement in the prophecy coincides with the statement, he shall destroy the mighty and the holy people? It'll do you a good exercise to find this out and give the answer back to me. You find it back there in between verses 9 and 12, which are the verses describing the little horn power. Good. It says in verse 10, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground, stamped upon them. So, who is the host? And who are the stars of the host? Let me have the answer in the words of the interpretation. The host are the mighty and the holy people, aren't they? And who are the stars of the host? The ministers. And who is the prince of the host, referred to in verse 11? Christ. Christ is the prince of the host. Christ is the head. The host is the body. And therefore the host, of course, is the mighty and the holy people. Now verse 25. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hands, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And those words, of course, discuss the various points made in verse 11 and 12. Let's now make a list of them. Verse 11, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. By him the daily was taken away, the place of his sanctuary was cast down, a host was given him against the daily by reason of transgression, and cast down the truth to the ground, and practiced and prospered. Now what a list of crimes we have in those particular verses. The three chief ones are as follows. One, he stamps upon the host. Two, he takes away the daily. And three, he casts down the place of Christ's sanctuary. Those are the three principal things that we find that the little horn power is accused of doing by God in this passage of Scripture. Let me pass on a moment further to verse 26, where the angel says, and the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Now, is that an explanation? Or is that but a statement which you'd expect to be followed by an explanation? Let me read the words again. The angel says, and the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. And the vision of the evening and the morning, of course, is the 2,300 days. Or the 2,300 evenings and the 2,300 mornings. Now, would you class that as an explanation? If someone came to you and said, all right, back there we told you that there would be 2,300 days during which time the sanctuary would be cast down and the abomination of desolation set up and the daily taken away. Now, that's true. Would you class the three words, that is true, as being an explanation to tell you when the 2,000 days should start, when they would end, and so forth? No, it's not. It's just a statement, which was to have been followed by the words that would describe or explain the 2,300 days. But the angel checks himself and quickly terminates his conversation in these words, wherefore shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days after I rose up and did the king's business, but and I was astonished at the vision,
but none understood it. Let's understand ourselves what Daniel was saying in verse 27. But first of all, let's ask the question, why did not the angel continue to provide a complete explanation at this point of time? Because Daniel was about to faint. And why was Daniel about to faint? Because of the unspeakably awful revelations which God was about, which God had just given him in this vision. Now, the few cryptic words of Scripture hardly describe all that Daniel saw. He beheld, in literal fact, the little horn power. He saw the little horn power going out there, conquering and to conquer, destroying, crucifying Jesus Christ, casting down and persecuting the people of God, taking away the daily, and worst of all, prolonging and delaying the second advent of Jesus and the establishment of God's eternal kingdom. So no wonder Daniel fainted in the light of that fearful revelation which was given to him. His human weakness was no longer able to bear the tremendous strain or burden of this revelation. And so the angel was obliged to stop explaining at this point, and no doubt he got a directive from God not to force the issue, not to give Daniel extra strength, but to let the matter naturally terminate at this point. Now, I must say that I am very, very thankful that Daniel did faint at this point of time, that God did not give the full explanation of the 2,300 days until later, because by giving the explanation later, God is able to give to us a fullness of revelation which would not have been possible had it been done at this point of time. I think you'll appreciate that point as we come back to our study period this afternoon to develop that particular truth. Now, let's move a little further to verse 27, where it says, "Now I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterwards I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." Did Daniel himself understand the vision? None of it? Right, he understood part of it. There's no doubt about the fact that Daniel understood that Medo-Persia was symbolized by the ram. He also understood very clearly that Grisha was symbolized by the he-goat. He knew a great king. He didn't know his name yet, of course. But he knew a great king was symbolized by one horn, after which had become four kings, also as yet unnamed. And beyond that, a great power, the name of which he did not know yet, which would dominate human history for a very, very long period of time. And no doubt at this point of time, he figured that the 2,300 days, which he perhaps also recognized as being years, maybe not, perhaps he was puzzled by that, would be the long, long period of duration of this kingdom. Now, of course, 2,300 days is less than 10 years. And Daniel could hardly envision this little horn power having so short a duration. And so no doubt he was very, very puzzled by the expression 2,300 days. So Daniel definitely understood all that had been explained to him, but the part he did not understand was the 2,300-day part of the prophecy. That was the puzzling part, and in turn, what would take place beyond the termination of that long period of time. And so he went about the king's business, a very, very puzzled man with this great burden on his mind. And then, a little later, of course, came the fall of Babylon and the rise of the Medo-Persian power, and it was in the first year of Darius, as the next chapter tells us, that Daniel now sought to understand more deeply the future of his people. And that introduces, of course, the explanation to the 2,300-day prophecy, but that we're going to have to leave down for our next study period. Time for this one is gone. I do trust, though, that our explanations in regard to Antiochus versus Rome make very, very clear which of those two powers was the power predicted by the prophecy. So we shall be fortified against Satan's devices in the soon coming struggle over these great truths in the end of time. Now, closing hymn is number 228. Number 228. I'd like to mention too that the Californian tapes are still here. There's still a good supply of them for anybody who wants them. So don't forget, if you do need them, come and see me and I'll be glad to give you a set of the Californian tapes which deal with the sanctuary truth rather than with the story of the book of Daniel.